Last night we were looking at the forest. Tonight we want to look at some of those trees that were in that forest. And it was my major concern last night that you see that overview. Now we want to look at some of the specific things. Before we do that, I want to deal with what I call the myth of the cycle theory. Now that's the thing you hear sometimes when you hear people talk of youth groups. They say things like this. This is the way the cycle theory goes. Every now and again a youth group will just flourish. Okay? There's no reason for that. It just happens that way. And then it'll just die away. And there's no reason for it dying away. Because everything happens in cycles. And it just so happens it'll just grow up and it'll go down again. And eventually it'll come up again, it'll go down again. And that's nobody's fault that it goes down. And it's nobody's credit that it grows up. It's just because everything happens in cycles. You heard that one? Things just go in cycles. And they would say that it doesn't grow because it's properly managed, nor do they collapse because they're mismanaged. Now I reject the cycle theory. I believe they collapse because they're mismanaged on a whole. Unless, of course, there's a major shift in population of the young people, and some communities do that, where the young people all grow up and there are no young people left in the community. That sort of thing happens. But taking those major shifts in the social makeup of a society, works collapse because something goes wrong. That's not just a cycle. And I want to share some of the reasons why I think they collapse. One is a change of leadership. A change of leadership can bring about that type of cycle phenomenon. Ineffective leaders can follow good leaders and they're unable to sustain the previous work. And so it appears to cycle down. Another reason is that leaders sometimes are unable to sustain the standard of ministry over a period of time. Some people are very good at short-term things and they go real well for 6 months and then they run out of ideas and they run out of energy and they run out of commitment. They kind of burn out a little bit and then they go. And while they're going energetic and flat out, the thing goes up a bit and then when they collapse or run out of ideas or whatever it is, it drops away. The other thing that can happen is that they can be going like a beauty, or seeming to, but making mistakes all along the line, and it doesn't catch up to them for 6 months or a year, and then all of a sudden things go wrong, and they don't really realise, but probably things were wrong all the time. An example of that would be the sort of thing we were talking about last night with an unbalanced program. If you were just having a lot of fun things going on all the time, you could well get a whole lot of kids coming really quickly, but they would eventually drop away because they need much more than that to sustain a proper program and to sustain a real ministry. The main reason I believe you get that sort of cycling effect is through poor management. Let's examine diagrammatically a youth group. Now this is the one, this one here is one where we imagine a youth group that picks kids up at 15, it's an older youth group, 15 to 20, okay, or 19, they sort of start dropping out of the youth group at the upper end at about 15, at about 20 rather, doing well tonight. And so we can imagine that people are coming in at the bottom as they graduate up from things like the rallies and the Sunday schools and things like that. They're coming in from the side, from converts, and they come out at the top into the church, we hope. Okay? Now, let's look at what I think happens when you get the cycling effect. What happens is you get growth at the upper edge and people working on growth at the upper edge. And the older kids, because they're the older and the more enthusiastic ones sometimes, and we'll look back at that again, they concentrate on building up people at that, their own peers. Okay? And they build up their youth group at the top edge. And it's really good, it gets bigger and bigger there. But this is the problem you get next year. A year later, they're half gone. Because they got too old. 2 years later, they're all gone. They're now producing kids for the crash. Okay, all married off and all gone. And you had a great thriving youth work. And now you've got no youth work. And you think, how could it all happen? We had so many youth 2 years ago. And all of a sudden, they've gone. What's gone wrong? They all got married. That's what's gone wrong. Now, this is what I suggest. That's not really anything wrong, actually. It's just the problem was you didn't have kids coming at the other end. Let's suppose that you place your emphasis in your recruiting at the bottom end of the group and at the sides. Are the people coming in? Now look what's happening next year. You've really established that. It's not that you neglect these other kids either, but here's where you're contracting on you're concentrating your recruiting. Those kids are consolidated right into the middle of the group now, in the second year, and you've got a new lot coming in. 2 years later, they're up there. 3 years later, they're there. And 4 years later, you're there. And it's not, and you've got each one then for 5 years. And in the meantime, because you're continuing to do that, by the time they're out there, you've got them all coming all the way through. That's a lot different. This type of thing very often happens because the older kids run the group. If you don't have somebody a bit older looking on and managing the show, that can happen very easily, and they'll balloon out at the top. That's because if the older kids run the group, they will tend to program it for themselves. They will do that unconsciously, although sometimes they might do it deliberately, but they'll do that unconsciously for a number of reasons. One is because they're in the group themselves, they have the most power, they're programmed for their own age group, because, you know, they're most conscious of their own friends. That's where they're getting the feedback from, and they've got pressure on them from their own age group. These kids are going to have incredible pressure on them from the age group of the 18 to 20 year olds to do things that really meet their needs, and they will not tend to hear the kids at this end. They might hear them. I think it's very, very difficult for an 18-year-old to consistently program for a 15-year-old. If you really get him in the exercise and sit down and say, but the 15-year-old won't do, oh yes, of course, you know, and they'll think, but to consistently do that is very, very difficult for them. It's much easier for somebody who's 30, or 25, 35, to sit up there because he can see the whole thing objectively. He's not so subjectively tied up. He's not under the peer pressure of the older age group. Okay? And then you don't get these cycle things happening so easily. And he can easily see, and he can assess the needs of the top group. He can assess the needs of the bottom group more objectively. And so what I'm saying is that concentrate in your recruiting on the incoming edge. And you won't find yourself in a situation of, boy, we had a fantastic youth group 2 years ago, but they're all gone. Somehow or other, they all grew up and moved away, which happens so often. Put up your hand if you're in a church where that's happened. Right. That happens so often. All right. We want to now have a look at some more goals. And now we want to think of the activity goals. Last night, we talked about the overall ministry goals, the things you're wanting to do overall, but then you have specific activities that are working together to achieve that overall goal of leading young people to maturity in Christ. And we want to look at and just share some principles regarding those actual activity goals. So if you're running a thing this Friday night, we're talking about the goals for this particular activity that's going to last for 2 or 3 hours and then be over with, not the goals of the 5-year program. First principle I'd like to share there is set specific goals for each activity. And that seems like a pretty obvious thing to say, but I can assure you that a lot of people don't do that. And I know that because people invite me to speak at youth programs and youth groups, and I say, now tonight I need to know what I'm going to say because I have to prepare an address and I need to know what you have in mind and your intentions for this night. And half the time they can't tell me. Or they'll say something like, to have a meeting for young people. Well, I know you're having a meeting for young people, but what are the goals of the meeting for the young people? See, just to have a meeting for the young people for the sake of having a meeting is not really good enough. What do you want that meeting to achieve? Or an activity or whatever it is. When I use a meeting tonight, I'm talking activity, okay? Do you want it to be something to teach them, or do you want it to be something for evangelism, or do you want to contact new kids? What's the purpose of it? If it's going to be evangelism, are you trying to sow the seed of the gospel or are you trying to reap? Is it that type of activity? Right, you need to set specific goals. Sit down and work out. What are you really trying to work that out to? What do you really want to happen that night in young people's lives? The second principle is that some goals don't mix. And sometimes when you do get a goal out of people, they say something like this. We want to have an activity that's going to really reach out to non-Christians and really teach the Christians something too, so they get something really out of it, some really in-depth meat. And you've got 20 minutes to do that. In other words, what they want is a general all-purpose meeting. And that tends to be like those general all-purpose tools you buy from Woolworths. You ever seen those things? They're kind of like, they're usually shaped something like pliers. And they've got kind of a bottle opener thing stuck somewhere and a screwdriver in there somehow and a bit of a hammer stuck in there as well. And all sorts of tools stuck in there, something. The trouble is with them, if you try and use them for any one of those things, it doesn't really work. And those meetings are a little bit like that. You're trying to do everything, and so you end up doing nothing. You can't achieve all those goals in the one event, and you usually end up not achieving any of them because you've compromised your objectives. And often a youth group night is something like a good fun night with a little devotional thing packed on the end. Now that's not bad, but that's not good evangelism. If you want it to be evangelism, it's better not to just have a little devotion tucked on the end. Have nights. If you're going to have a fun night, have a fun night. If you're going to have an evangelism night, have an evangelism night. If you're going to have a teaching night, have a teaching night. Okay? When it's going to be fun, let it be fun. You don't have to stick a little thing on the end just to make it legitimate. Fun's fun in itself. Fun's legitimate in itself. Have different meetings, have different activities to achieve different goals, and move all of the events of that activity along to achieve that one goal. Don't compromise your objectives by trying to do too many different things and try and meet too many different things on the one night. Otherwise you end up usually achieving very little at all. You can run different activities to achieve different goals on different occasions. Now, I want to make some comments about evangelism. The first comment, and we are picking up now some of the things we talked about last night, first comment is that evangelism is a long-term concern. And it needs to be seen in our planning and in the way we deal with non-Christians as a long-term concern. That means we need to allow time and lots of time for sowing the seed and then reaping, okay, the harvest at some later date. We need to allow time for meaningful interaction to occur between the Christians and the non-Christians. Now I want to talk about sowing because I think we don't think about sowing the seed enough. And the scriptures talk about sowing and reaping as two activities of evangelism. Now it's better to sow plenty of seed over a long period of time than to sow few seeds and try to reap immediately. The farmer that gets a big crop is not the farmer that spends a lot of time in his harvester, but the farmer that spends a lot of time sowing the seed. Now, the more you sow, the greater is the potential for the harvest. And when we come to if a farmer comes to get a crop, the first thing he does is he doesn't go and get in his harvester. The first thing he does if he wants to get a crop is he goes and gets his bulldozer and clears away the forest. Then he starts digging in and pulling out rocks out of the ground, and then he gets a plough and he ploughs up the ground, and he does a lot of preliminary work, and then he sows the seed, and then he waters, and then he fertilises, and sometime later, usually a year or so later, he pulls out his harvester and he starts harvesting. Now, that, I think, is not what most evangelicals try to do when they start doing evangelism. They say, we're going to do evangelism this Friday night. They go out there, have a shot, and they start at 7 o'clock, and they're sort of clearing the ground from about 7 till about 10 past. They're starting to plough it up a bit from 10 past to half past. Then they're sowing the seed, you know, from half past 7 till 8 o'clock, and then they're supposed to be reaping after that. It really doesn't work out like that at all. And we wonder why we don't get a harvest. Now the reason we don't get a harvest is not because we're not harvesting. I think we're trying to harvest all the time. The reason we don't get a harvest is because we don't sow. We spend too much time trying to harvest. we get in the old harvester straight away and try and reap people into the kingdom before we've sown much seed at all. Now, you can easily get the impression that this is the way to do it sometimes from the scriptures, because you look at isolated little accounts of people being converted, and it appears that Jesus rolled up to somebody, like the disciples in Matthew 4, and said, you know, come follow me, so immediately they drop their nets and follow him. And you can easily get the impression that, because no gospel writer writes a full story, that it's supposed to happen instantaneously. Now, sometimes it does happen instantaneously, but that account I just referred to in Matthew 4, when Jesus went and called Andrew and Peter and they came and followed him, we got some interesting background to that, because in John chapter 1 it tells us that sometime before that, and it would have been a long time before that, Jesus spent a full day with those guys. And it would have been, we know it was a long time before that, because the account in John chapter 1 occurred well before the imprisonment of John the Baptist, whereas the account in Matthew 4, when Jesus actually came and called them and they dropped their nets and followed him, occurred well after the imprisonment of John the Baptist. So we know there's a big space in between, and Jesus had spent a full day with those guys, and by the end of that day they were convinced that he was the Messiah. So when Jesus rolls up to them, and then he could have spent a lot of other time with them for all we know besides that, though it's not recorded. So when Jesus rolls up to them and says, come follow me, be my disciples, be fishers of men and all that, and they drop their net, he's doing that on the basis of a whole lot of groundwork. Jesus has been sowing a lot of seed before that actual event occurred. Now, what I'm saying is what I'm just reiterating what I said last night. It takes a long time on the whole to get somebody converted. You've got to be able to operate in a way where you can maintain contact with him for a long time. Now, John French, the author, the brother guy from Perth, who many of you would know or at least have heard of, when he was speaking on this topic at Wynnum a couple of years ago, he said that for the average person, it's based on certain research, for the average person, adult person to be converted, it normally takes 5 years from the point of first contact to the time they've come to conversion. Now, as I said, some people do it instantly, but they're the exceptions, and we must not operate as if the exceptions are the norm. Now, it's been our experience of the Wynnum program, as we talked about last night, that for a young person it would take up from 1 to 2 years to get them through to conversion. 1 to 2 years of continual ministry and continual contact. Now, in my view, sowing and reaping are really different activities. We tend to think that when you start working with somebody, at the early part you're sowing and at the second part you're reaping. And we tend to work it out as just the timing of it all. But I have a sneaky idea there's more to it than that. I believe that sowing involves not only the communication of the gospel, but preparing the way for the gospel, bringing the person to a state of mind, giving him the background information, getting him to question his personal stance that he had before that, so that he sees the gospel is relevant, and so he sees the gospel is true, and so that at a later date, when the gospel does come to him, he accepts it. Now, I'm not saying we should be withholding the gospel from him early on. We should be telling him the gospel, but at the same time, we should be doing all the other things so that at a later date, when he's ready to hear the gospel he's been hearing all the time, he will be able to respond to, because you've removed all the obstructions away from it in his own mind. I remember being asked to do a camp. I had a previous commitment and I couldn't make it, so I knew I was only going to arrive just before the actual session, so I had no chance to assess the kids I was going to be dealing with. And so I said to the leaders, look, what are these kids like? What sort of level ought I come in? Should I come in at some sort of base of teaching them some apologetics or of showing the relevance of the gospel? And they said to me, oh, no, so you don't need to do that. He says, we've been sowing the seed with these kids for 2 years. So you just need to come in and just challenge them with the gospel. John 3:16, all that stuff. Okay. Which, like a goof, I did. And the kids, it just fell off their backs just fell off them like water off a duck's back. And I sit down and start talking to those kids on the weekend, and I mean, most of them didn't believe in God. They could see no relevance in all this sort of stuff. And these people say to me, look, we've been sowing the seed for 2 years. Now, I really question whether they've been sowing the seed for 2 years. I know they've been working with them for 2 years. I know they've been talking to them about God for 2 years. But whether they've been really sowing the seed, I really think that what they've been doing is trying to reap for 2 years. They've been coming up with John 3:16 messages in a different format with different illustrations every night for 2 years, and yet the kids are there sitting down saying, well, we don't know whether there's really a God after all, and I'm not too sure that Jesus is God, and I'm not too sure whether he did rise from the dead, and we don't know about all this sin stuff anyhow, because we're not too sure whether there's any such thing as right or wrong anyhow. With this thing, maybe these are just little moral conventions that people make up. And these issues are not addressed, and so that the message tends to not really cut in on the people, because the groundwork is not done. The days are gone when we can preach the gospel to ears that have the correct presuppositions to respond to it immediately. Those days have been gone for 2 decades. People don't necessarily believe there's a God. People don't necessarily, when you talk about Jesus being the Son of God, merely just accept that. People don't necessarily believe there's such a thing as sin, in the sense of things being absolutely right or wrong. And you talk to kids in high school, and they'll tell you, sin's just a rule. That's just rules that people make up. You make them up, and we can come along and we can make different ones up. They're just ideas like that. That's just a concept. If you want to live by that, you can. But there's no reason why I should live by that. There's no reason why I should feel bad if I don't live by that. And they operate along those lines. And it's those sorts of things that ought to be addressed and ought to be hammered in on. And I think that's the sort of thing that becomes sowing the seed and bringing the person to a position where the gospel is going to make an impact on his life. Now, in sowing the seed, to me, it seems most important that we cut in somehow on the value system of the non-Christian. He has to see the gospel message that we preach as somehow relevant to the daily issues he faces here and now. And I think it's most important to do what I call is hit the point of departure in their thinking. We need to concentrate on the beliefs and presuppositions behind the actions and attitudes and beliefs we see in them that we see are wrong. For example, if we illustrate it diagrammatically, it's like this. Let's suppose that's the truth. That's right down the line the truth, the Christian way, perfectly obeyed, Bible truth, perfectly obeyed. Now, everybody, every non-Christian at least, and everybody else to some degree, deviates from that. And so that we can come to a point in their life and we can compare what's really happening in their life, what they're really doing from what they should be doing, what they're really believing from what they should be believing. Okay? So that perhaps we might come up to a young person and he's into drugs. And then we can say, well, the truth is no drugs. So we could put that down. There's drugs and there's no drugs. Now, here, I put, is the point of departure. Now, what we tend to do is we tend to hit him at this point. We tend to be coming into him in arguments like, I mean, if you want to take drugs as an example, which this is only an example of a whole lot of things we do, look, you shouldn't be taking drugs, that's naughty, that'll hurt you. You might get addicted, you'll wreck your body, and you might die early, and things like that. And we hit him with all these sort of arguments about why he shouldn't take drugs. And the effect of it is that he sits there and says, but you know, that's a different world, why not? And we tend to think that those arguments actually mean something to him, but in fact, very often, they don't mean a lot to him, and it's been shown, really, that type of approach of scaring them off drugs doesn't really scare them off drugs. Those kids know full well it's going to hurt them. They know full well before they even take their first drugs, most of them. And in fact, the reason they're taking those drugs is because they really don't have any sense of meaning in life anyhow, and they think life is meaningless, and they're taking the drugs because the drugs give them a bit of kick, and because you feel good now when you're on a trip, that gives your life a sense of meaning and purpose. Now, if you're really struggling to gain some meaning in life, you know, telling you might die young is not such a big threat. These are the people that the biggest killer of these young people is suicide, apart from motor accidents. You come to people who are saying, there's no point in life, so I'm tripping out, and you tell them, don't do that, you might get killed, say, there's no point in life anyhow, fella. Okay? And the only point in life that they're seeing is the little trip they're having. And that sort of thing just doesn't really cut ice. It just, I mean, they can see some sense in it, perhaps, but it doesn't really grab them. But the point, but if you trace that back and look at the presuppositions, the in their beliefs and in their behaviour, the things that's gone on behind it, is this issue of the meaning of life. That's where you hit the point of departure, and there's even a point further back to that we're going to come to. If there's no meaning in life, then it's not such a dumb idea getting into drugs. But if there's a meaning in life, if there's purpose to life, then it is a silly idea. You don't have to go, you know, shooting your brain in order to convince yourself that life's worth living till tomorrow. You don't have to live like that. There is a purpose in life. Now, that comes back again to another thing behind that. There's a purpose in life because there's a God. And that's just a simple fact. If there's no God, there's no purpose in life. And they're not so, we're maybe the dumb ones. Now, I'm suggesting to you that rather than just attack them at that point, the point up there, we come back to the issues behind it. We come back to those other things and hit them back there, because that's where they're departing from the truth. Okay? This is just the result of it. Now, if you just hit at this level, what they do is they just end up sort of saying, okay, let's just brush it away. And we tend to do that. We tend to condemn these wrong actions and wrong beliefs without tracing it back to the causes. No harm in condemning it if you go back to the causes. I suppose there's no harm in condemning it anyhow, it's just that it doesn't have as much effect. But we go back without tracing it back to the corners. And then they just pass Christianity off as irrelevant, as belonging to a different world to theirs. I say, look, that's just your thing. This is my thing. Okay? You live your life in your world with your no-drugs, little clean world, and I'll live my life in my world with my drugs. But when you come back and you trace it back, okay, to that point of departure, Christianity then is seen as something that they must evaluate for themselves, because it does threaten their own world. It challenges their position. Because they've got to actually make a choice. Not between drugs or no drugs. That's seen as two different worlds. There's a drug group over here and there's the non-drug group over there. But it's seen as an issue they must face for them. Is there really meaning in life? Or isn't there meaning in life? And that comes back to the question of whether there's God or not. Now that's just one example, and the same thing happens with intellectual problems that they face, that they put up with you and stuff like that. The creation evolution debate and those sorts of things. Don't just necessarily deal with it at the level that they place it with you, but take it back, right back to the point where the truth and non-truth converge, and deal with it there. And there it's harder for them to escape. There it's harder for them to say, look, that's a non-issue for me. That it's harder for them to say, look, that belongs to your religious world and it doesn't belong to my world. That just belongs to you straight people. It doesn't belong to me, you know. It belongs to you older people. It's not part of my scene. You know, they can't do it when you do take it back that way. They've got to see it as something that they've got to address and they've got to come to terms with. So they're the sorts of things, I think, that are very, very important as part of the sowing the seed. Now, as I said, and this is all part of that other point we've been making, that this evangelism has got to be this long-term concern. You've got to be sowing the seed. It takes a long time to go through all that sort of stuff with people. And then reaping it when the time comes. And that strategy that we put to you last night, that's a strategy that can help you to keep working with young people for the long time. You'll find that what I would tend to do is, as you go on the outer circles, do more sowing type stuff in your information that you're actually passing on, and as they come in, do more reaping type information of repent and believe. Not that you're not doing that in the other things, but it's a matter of emphasis. Okay? Right, the next point is eliminate unnecessary church culture. We made that point again last night, but we need to build on it In order to maintain extended contact with non-Christians, in your evangelistic activities, they need to fit into their cultural setting. They need to be part of...
Please turn the tape over at this point.
In order to maintain extended contact with non-Christians, in your evangelistic activities, they need to fit into their cultural setting. They need to be part of what they can feel as their world. And if it's not part of what they can feel as their world, something that they can identify with and feel comfortable with, they usually won't stay there long enough for you to go through the process of sowing the seed, bringing them to a point where they really evaluate the gospel message, and then bringing them to a point of commitment. Now that means that we've got to avoid doing things that only Christians do. And I gave the example last night of community singing. I'm absolutely serious about that. I think community singing and evangelistic events causes, you know, it just puts immense stumbling blocks in people. I think it's a great barrier to evangelism. And I think we ought to really eliminate that from evangelistic activities. The message should be the gospel, but the setting in which the gospel message is declared should be activities that the non-Christian can appreciate, that he can feel part of, feel not threatened by. And as I said last night, and I'll say it again, people who turn away from our activities and turn away from our ministry are often not rejecting the gospel message because they haven't heard the gospel message, they haven't stuck around long enough to really get a grasp of what the gospel message is about, but they're rejecting the culture that we put the gospel message in, and they're rejecting that culture before they've had a decent chance to really evaluate that message and know what that message is really about. Now I think this is a significant test of commitment for a Christian group, a significant test of equipment for a Christian leader. I mean, are you really committed enough to Christ to miss out on doing something you really like community singing, for the sake of the gospel? Now I like community singing too. But are you really committed enough to Christ to miss out on that, if that's really a stumbling block, a barrier to people sitting around and staying there long enough to hear the gospel and go through the processes of really working it through? Are you committed enough to Christ to use music you don't particularly like, that you'd rather not hear, for the sake of the gospel? Now look, I personally don't particularly like modern youth music. It was pretty good in the 60s, that's when I was a teenager. Okay? That's when they sung proper youth music. but I use it all the time. I don't like it. In fact, I'm fairly conservative in my tastes. Some of the newer stuff, like Dire Straits, that's nice, softer type rock music, that's nicer. But some of the other stuff, I just don't like one scrap. And I don't like a lot of the Christian music. It's not my scene. I like, really, if you look at my record collection, I've got a lot of classical stuff there. I like Strauss and that sort of stuff, personally. But I know full well, I mean, if I play Strauss at a youth program, what's going to happen? And I'm putting up a stumbling block. It really is a stumbling block, that sort of thing. What I like, my personal tastes have got absolutely nothing to do with what we should be doing. The question is, am I prepared to be all things to all men? That's the question. And just as that meant certain things to the Apostle Paul, it means certain things for us today. Different things, but it means specific things. If you're in youth work, it means the sort of music you're going to wear. And why put unnecessary stumbling blocks in the way? And I think we do it all the time. And we do it without thinking. We just like doing this and we like doing that, so that's what we're going to do. Without having a look at these people, what are these Christian, non-Christian kids really like? And what sort of things are we going to do if we're going to evangelize them in their cultural setting? It means you're going to do something that's different to what you normally do if you're going to do it. Now, if you're going to do that, if you're going to evangelize in their subcultural setting, means that you're going to have to understand that culture, find out certain things about it, and that's going to require hard work. That is a continual struggle for me, to keep up to date with what's going on. I don't think I'm very good at keeping up to date. I don't know all the rock bands. I never try to know them all. But at least I keep up with the general scene. I know the sorts of things that are going on. And I make a point sometimes of watching shows on television I don't like watching. I don't particularly detest like watching them, but it's not my idea of entertainment. But I make a point. I make a point of listening to the radio stations so that they aren't my type of music. I don't do it all the time, but I make a point of keeping in touch with the sort of thing that's happening. I make a point of reading certain magazines that I'm not meaning bad magazines by that. I make a point of reading certain magazines that isn't the sort of literature I'd like to read, because I know it gives me insights into what's happening out there. I make a point of just sitting down at particular places and watching how young people operate and what they do. Make a point of talking to them and stuff like that. You've got to actually go out of your road to do that sort of thing. And Bill would know, being a missionary overseas, if you're going to operate cross-culturally, you've got to go out of your road. And if you're going to be a good youth worker, you're going to have to operate cross-culturally, and you're going to have to go out of your road and do a lot of things you don't normally do. Now, because of this, because it requires a deliberate effort to work cross-culturally, to take the initiative to go places you don't go, to meet them and to contact them, and to work cross-culturally in operating in a cultural situation that's not your own culture, then one of the greatest threats to youth work is legalism. Legalism in a church where they say, listen, you can't do this or you can't do that. You can't have this sort of music, or you can't have that sort of music, or you can't do this sort of thing, or do that sort of thing. That will kill a youth work program-wise. Because where legalism dominates, those cultural changes, those cross-cultural adjustments that are necessary are nearly always prohibited. And if they are allowed, they're usually delayed until it's too late. And we're always one step behind on the youth culture. If we're lucky, usually four. Okay. Now, what normally happens in this sort of scene is people work on this sort of logic. I don't like it, therefore it's wrong. Okay? I don't like that, so we're not going to have that. It's wrong because I don't like it for no other reason, and that's that. Now, this is nothing new. In fact, it's probably not well known, but Isaac Watts, the great hymn writer, in his own day was canned. He had the same sort of reception, sort of like Larry Norman gets today. Okay? He was a radical. People wouldn't sing his hymns. He was regarded as a naughty boy. And now we sing his hymns and it's super conservative stuff and it's really good stuff to sing. But in his own day, they wouldn't have it. It was devil's music. And we have to be careful. Because today's devil's music becomes tomorrow's classics sometimes. Makes me wonder whether we're going to be turning up in 200 years' time. Somebody, would you turn up hymn number 402 and we'll sing Larry Norman's Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? You know? And how often does it happen in church? I remember when I was a kid, people banning TV, you know, making big pronunciations about TV. 10 years later, those same blokes are watching it. And they do the same sort of thing with youth work, you know. You can't do this, you can't do that, and 10 years later it's okay. I'm not saying we don't have any standards. I think there are lots of standards we ought to apply. And we've got a clear guide as to where to get those standards. You get the standards from the scripture. If God says you can't do something, you can't do something. The problem is that legalists all their time say things for God that God never said for himself. And I figure if God needed to say it, and if God thought it was really wrong, he would have said it for himself. Right, the quality of the youth program. Modern man has very sophisticated tastes, and he strives, and quality is important, and we need to strive for quality. However, quality is not the only consideration. As we were talking about last night, relationships between the organisers and the youth, I believe, are more important than quality. Now, it's sometimes better to sacrifice a degree of quality in your program in order to make use of people who are known and accepted and loved and have that response from the peers of the group. It's the old story, it's not what you say but who says it that counts. Now we kid ourselves really when we look at our youth programs, because We sometimes think that kids come to our programs because of the quality of the program. Now, that's because we compare our programs to a Sunday morning church service, and we compare the sort of music we're dishing up to the church organ. But when you compare it to what the non-Christian kids have got in the secular community, what we dish up in our youth programs, and even in the very good youth programs, is nothing like, and the quality, let alone anything else, the quality of entertainment provided that the best youth groups can provide, with few exceptions, is nothing like the quality they can get outside in terms of pure entertainment. And yet youth turn their backs on those things, and they come to Christian programs. And why do they come to those Christian programs? They come for relationships. Now, we need to recognise that. Now, what I'm saying is not true of citywide youth concert rally things. Now, things like Saturday Date, I think in those sort of things, they're kind of Christian shows, and in those things, quality is what it's all about. But when it comes to a local church, I don't think it quite works by the same dynamics. Now, what we did at Wynnum, we had in our evangelistic program, we had a thing called ONPOS, and we had stacks of non-Christians come. I think in the last few years, I don't think the attendance ever dropped under 200 at that, and the bulk of those kids came from the community. It wasn't just a lot of kids coming from other churches, and a good half of that audience would have been non-Christian kids, and they came month after month, year after year. Now, how we worked that is we had a framework of real quality acts in there. We would bring in people who were very, very good at what they did. They would provide the framework, but then we'd make use, and they would provide the quality, and then we'd make use of the kids' own peers in the program. So that, you know, kids who were known, or the younger adults who were known by the kids, who had real relationships with them, and we'd make use of them in the program and whatever we had. So we had both the quality on the one hand, but the relationships on the other. Now, that made a lot of difference with promoting it, because I'd often go to the school on the Friday that was on, and you just hang around and you'd hear kids talking. You're coming to ONCOS tonight, Billy's singing. See, that sort of thing. We know Billy. And then, and we'll go because Billy's our mate. It made a lot of difference with the effect of it, because the message is not just the message that some guy is saying, it's what Billy says, and we know Billy. We know what he's like. And then and we know all his friends. And the whole program then ends up reinforcing those kids' testimony, and their testimony reinforces the program. And even the message kind of gets imputed to what Billy has to say, to some extent, and it gets identified with him back at the school and with all the other Christian kids who are part of putting the program on. Right, next point is atmosphere. While the quality should be aimed for in a program, we need to note that today's youth place tremendous emphasis on the atmosphere generated in the program. For some reason, to do with their existentialist type philosophy that young people have, is that if the activity didn't feel good, it wasn't very good, no matter how well it was organised. And sometimes kids will come home and say, that program was flat, and parents will say, I didn't think it was pretty good. And they look at the way it was organised, how smoothly it ran, the quality of the acts and stuff like that. But a kid isn't so much looking at that. He does see that. He feels the program. And if it doesn't feel right, it's not right. Okay? And that, what makes it feel good is not just what's on the program. What makes it feel good is very much affected by the total setting, the size of the room, how many people's there, the lighting, the seating, all that, and the timing of the program, all of those sorts of things affect the atmosphere. And that atmosphere is an extremely important thing. All right, now let's make some miscellaneous points about youth work. Firstly, segregate into age groups. A 12-year-old is totally different to an 18-year-old. He's different socially, physically, and mentally. And we saw that last Monday night. It's extremely difficult, unless you have a very, very small group, I would say it's impossible to run a program that can cater for all of those sort of age groups, right from about 12-year-old right through to 19. The subject matter, if you're saying stuff that will be stimulating to the older kids, it'll be right over the heads of the younger ones. If you're saying something that's stimulating to the younger ones, it'll be boring to the older ones. The style of program's totally different. The older kids don't like the sort of running around stupid little antics that the little kids get up to. You just can't do it. They are totally different. I can never get over it every year now. I mean, I've been doing it now for years. If you go to the high school for the first time in the year, and you look at those great apes and you say, well, who let them in? You know, the little shorn off little runts, and you think, good grief. You know, they're so different to to the grade nines that were there at the end of last year. They're just so much smaller, and they usually bunch together and swarm over the place like cold to crab. I don't know. There's just no way you can integrate all of those age groups in one effective program. You need to split them up. At Wynnum, we work them from 12 to 14, and then from 15 to 19. It's the way we split them, but there's other ways of slicing up the cake. B, integration with the church. A youth ministry must see itself as part of the church ministry as a whole. Therefore, the goals of the youth ministry must be consistent with that of the whole church, and it must integrate with other church ministries. Now, we need to give special attention to transitions. If you're running a youth group, transitions are extremely important. You're going to have young people perhaps transitioning from a younger group to your group, at a rally or Sunday school or some junior youth group, perhaps, and you're going to have to be transitioning those kids from your group out again into the church as a whole or to another group further up. Now, you have to prepare kids for that. You have to prepare kids to orientate into your group. You have to prepare kids to orientate out of your group. Now, most churches have big losses in the transitions. They work real good with the kids, and the leaders work real good. It's partly to do, I think, with the mentality of the leaders. They think they're only their responsibility while they've got them in that group, and the important thing is they have a big group in their group. And once the kids come to the end, they kind of forget about them, and they really don't have the same level of commitment to getting them into the next group as they have from keeping them in their own. You see, the goal is not just to meet the present needs of youth, not just to get youth coming to your group, but to get them to fully participate in the life of the church so that they'll be active, committed Christians in 50 years' time. That's the goal. Now, youth workers, and this is a very important point, youth workers must be committed to eventually losing the youth from their own program. I'll say that again. A youth worker, if he's to have a mature Christian attitude to youth work, must be committed to losing his youth from his own program. And to me, it's a real test of commitment for a youth worker, or a test of his spiritual maturity, is seen in how hard he will work to shift the person out of his own program. Most will tend to hang on and hang on and hang on simply because they want more kids, bigger statistics and all sorts of stuff, and he wants more kids in his program. And how many youth workers there are, I don't know, but how many there are who destroy young people's lives by hanging on to them too long, so that instead of going up to the next section of the church's ministry, they keep them in theirs for a long, long time until eventually then it's no longer suitable to them, and then they drop out. They drop out of the whole church, and once they've dropped out of the whole church and dropped out of the scene, it's usually too late for anybody to pick them up. And you must be committed, if you're a youth worker, to getting rid of your kids. Discipline. A few people are asking things about discipline. The key to crowd control, ultimately, is the core group. If you teach your Christian core kids to behave, then the non-Christian kids will conform to that. And that's how people work anyway. You go to the movies or wherever you go, you look around, see how other people behave, and you say, well, this is how people behave, this is how you behave. And your Christian kids will set the standard for the group. So you need to teach them to behave, and you need to teach them in evangelistic activities to not talk and things like that. Don't you talk, because if you talk, then other kids will talk. If you put on the image, if you show people that you're not to talk here, then other people learn you're not to talk. And you teach them. Look, if somebody next to you, if a non-Christian kid comes next to you and he talks, then ask him not to. That's not our job, that's your job. You don't want to bring some non-Christian friend along and him to talk, and then a whole lot of other kids talk and a whole lot of other kids talk. You don't want us to embarrass you all by having to get up and say, now listen, you guys, you're all going to belt up. I mean, that's an ugly thing. You don't want that to happen. Now look, the way to stop that happening is for, if one person talks, you say, you know, look, would you mind being quiet? I'm trying to listen, just nicely. And the first thing they'll do if you say that is they'll try to draw you into a conversation about why you shouldn't talk. Okay? So if they say, why not? You just don't answer. Just listen, you know? And you teach your kids those sorts of things. Okay? Now occasionally you're going to get kids who aren't going to wear that hook. In other words, you teach your kids to put a group pressure on. that the discipline comes from inside the peer group rather than is externally applied. And it becomes a self-discipline of the group itself. Occasionally that'll break down, of course, and often it's my usual practice that if at an evangelistic activity the things got a bit wild, I probably, in most cases, would do nothing about it then. But wait till the next time the Christian group are together. And a rebuke at the level 3, you'd be surprised how a rebuke at level 3 goes right through, even though the rest of them didn't hear it. The effect of that will affect all of the operation, because those inner circle kids set the tone for everything else that happens. Just with other kids, if they don't respond to that type of thing, there are times to kick kids out of groups. Okay? Or to ground them for a while, or things like that. I mean, there's a whole area there we could spend half an hour talking about, but we won't. But it's better to get rid of a kid who's going to be a troublemaker than to have him get rid of 50 kids. Okay? Evaluation. Always, point one, always evaluate an activity in terms of its goals. If the goal of the activity was evangelism, then that's how you evaluate it. How well did we evangelize? Was the gospel clearly presented? Was it communicated? Did the people understand it? Was there opportunity to respond in some way? Not necessarily overt way, but were they challenged? If the goal was contacting, there's a very simple way of evaluating the goal that was contacting. Count up the new people. Now, if you had an activity for contacting and 20 kids got saved, but no new people came, then the activity failed. I'm absolutely serious. The activity failed in terms of its goals. Now, I mean, it's a good way to fail, but if that were to happen, we've got to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves in these things to know what's really going on, to know how we're going. If that were to happen, then that committee in charge of that activity should sit down, have a good time of praising the Lord for those 20 people that were saved, and then ask themselves why the activity failed. Failed to contact new people. You must evaluate in terms of its goals. Secondly, in your feedback, solicit feedback from a broad range of people. You know, you might get one little group of people say, we didn't like that activity, and you think, wow, you know, big trouble, or one person, or this person, or that person. And sometimes it may not be a representative group at all, and we can get all upset about nothing. Or somebody might really like something, but, you know, the older kids will often like something, but the younger ones won't. And you've got to make sure that your feedback is representative. 3, evaluate an activity in terms of the people it was designed for. If a non-Christian comes to a Bible study and he doesn't like it because he's too religious, we're not going to change it. We say to him, look, this is geared for kids who really want to know about God, okay? And for those kids, you know, we have other activities for kids to have fun and stuff like that. This activity is geared for the kids that really want to know about God and get into the Bible. Now, if you're not ready for that, that's fine. You know, stick around the other activities. If you want to come, you can, but realise that what it's going to be about. We're not going to change it for you, okay? Now, if you don't want to come yet, you know, maybe you stick around the other activities for a while, and if the time comes when you feel ready for Bible studies, you come then, okay? We're not going to think you're no good or you're a slacker or something like that, but you come when you're ready, but we won't change it now. If you have a contacting fun event and some theology student thought it was no good because there wasn't a study on Zechariah, don't take much notice of it. Now, sometimes it's quite difficult to know the real cause of an activity's failure. And it's difficult to know how to really rectify it. There's a tendency sometimes to attack the problems at the wrong end. We're a bit like the guy tried to get rid of the spots because he had chicken pox, you know? Sometimes, and we tend to attack symptoms rather than problems. And I think what we tend to do is we tend to prop up the end results of ministry rather than stimulate the true causes. Are you with me? We try to prop up the end results rather than stimulate the true causes. Now, example of that would be, say if the attendance drops at an evangelistic activity, now the normal response will be from people, well, we've got to sharpen up the program. Okay? Kids start dropping off. You've got to sharpen the program up, you know, get another colour in the publicity. Get Cliff Richard to sing next time. Something like that. Now, often that might be the case that the programming was at fault. It might be, but more often than not, in my experience, the real problem's in the contacting area. It's in the relationship areas. We tend not to think about it. See, you're seeing the result of it in the activity. You're seeing, you know, the symptom, but the real cause is something nothing to do directly with that activity itself. And it's naive to think that the better the program automatically means more people. Okay? The better the program automatically means you'll get more people out of your contacting base. But good programs don't build you a contacting base, nor do they extend your contacting base. Delegation. It's important to take care in delegating. Most young people don't think strategically, and so the strategy should not be delegated to them. But they are capable of accepting responsibility, and that's good training for them to have responsibility. However, there are two important considerations. One, to what extent should the quality of programs be sacrificed to facilitate youth participation? To what extent should the quality of programs be sacrificed to facilitate youth participation? Because if you get them involved, the quality will drop in most cases. Secondly, to what extent should a young person be involved in organisation at the expense of personal ministry to his peers? To what extent should a young person be involved in organisation at the expense of personal ministry to his peers? Now, those questions can only be answered in the specific situations. But just regarding that second one, youth, I think, unfortunately, are often pushed out of ministry roles, peer ministry roles, into organisational roles that should be the responsibility of the leaders. So when you give your kids something to do, some sort of background thing like organising cooking the sausages or something or other, you ask yourself, is it better for him to cook the sausages or is it better for him to be talking to his friends? Because if he's cooking the sausages, he's most likely not talking to his friends. Now, sometimes it might be better, but sometimes it might be better to get Mrs. Smith to go and cook the sausages so that he can get out there and talk to his friends. Now, those sort of issues ought to be thought through. When you give somebody something, and you can actually really undermine your whole program by giving your kids so much to do organisationally that they never minister to their peers. And you lose the force of all that peer ministry, even though the kids are doing all sorts of things and we solve all sorts of organisational problems, but you lose the effect of that thrust of peer ministry. Okay, just quickly now, be sensitive to change. The youth culture is constantly changing, so if you're going to be continuing to effectively work cross-culturally, you're going to have to be constantly adjusting. Secondly, youth appreciate change, and you need to keep enthusiasm running high with constant innovations. Look, as soon as you settle for the status quo, you're finished. Okay? As soon as you can get down and put a program together easily, without sitting down and thinking about it and having to come up with new ideas and having to struggle with it, it's going to pay, you're going to pay for it. You shouldn't put programs together without struggles. If it's too easy, there's something wrong. Okay? And programs should never become predictable with young people. They should never get to the stage where you say, well, we know what's going to happen this Friday night. We've seen it all before. Okay, you're going to have this. Take them by surprise. Always have the little thing in so they never quite know, what's going to happen next. Not that it's all haywire and stuff, but you've always got these little extra things coming in. That requires a lot of reading, a lot of picking up ideas. Remember what I said yesterday, we've got to assume that the best methods for youth ministry haven't been found yet. Keep looking for them. Finally, personal contact. It's most important to get beside youth in all of this sort of thing, no matter how your programming is going. Apart from all setting up good programming, to get behind youth, to encourage youth, and encourage them to get beside their peers. It's the personal relationships we've been saying all along that are the basis of all ministry, not the activities. The activities provide a setting for that for those personal relationships. That's for evangelism. In evangelism, no program could substitute for the personal witness that's going on. No publicity can replace Christians bringing along their non-Christian friends. Publicity is really only a tool, a little handbill. It doesn't bring people along. It just makes it easier for some kid to invite his friend along. He can give it to him, and then he knows the place and the time, and he knows what's happening, he knows when to be ready, and all that sort of stuff. Okay? It's naive to think you put out publicity, publicity brings people. People bring people. Pastoral care, and we're dealing with this tomorrow night, no program can substitute for pastoral care one-to-one. And we need to ensure that each young person has an older, mature, big brother or sister caring for them. And we're going to look at that tomorrow night. If you don't organise that, it means some kids will miss out. Alright, what we'll do now is we'll split up, come back at 5 past, and we'll get into the evaluation of your little groups you did last night.